Welcome to the Ask a Cycling Coach podcast presented by Trainer Road, the only podcast dedicated to making you a faster cyclist. We have our, Nate, you're with us. Our Hello. CEO, Nate Hi. Pearson. It's exciting to have Nate.
Thanks for having me.
Yeah, it's good to have you. No sunglasses this time. People are going to be very upset. Maybe you can go find some at some point throughout this episode and bring them in. We also have Ventum Bikes Ivy Audrain, and we're going to talk about green powders today. We're also going to talk about slow tires. We're going to talk about sleep optimization, a handful of other things. It's going to be good stuff. But first, Nate, is tradition now when you are on the podcast, we talk about new things that we're doing with Trainer Road. So what's new? We have a lot of things we're working on, but I guess picking on one specific topic, what's new?
Yeah, this is really proud for us is that Apple contacted us before they launched this next iOS 17 and said, we want you to be part of the companies that launch that support pushing workouts to Apple Watch and then using them outside. And for our case, it'd be cycling. So we work with Apple. The team worked extremely hard. There was a team, I think 15 or something on it doing it. And they worked. It was just amazing. I'm so proud of the team about how well they worked together. Interacting with Apple, and you know, when you do things that are unreleased, you'll find bugs and stuff and then work together to fix them. So anyways, what happens now is that before, a couple of weeks ago, you could do your outside workouts on a Garmin or a Wahoo outside, right? Now you can push them to Apple Watch, but now in iOS 17, what's really cool is Apple Watch will mirror that display onto your iPhone. So you can put your iPhone onto your handlebars. It runs from the Apple Watch, but you can see your ride data as you're riding outside. And then once you're done, it will upload back to Trainer Road. So it's another option for a different interface. This is just launched. I'm sure Apple will change the interface and improve it as it goes on. We don't have control, so we can't really edit ourselves, but it's really cool to be able to do that. And it's also let us get into some things where we connect to Apple Health. And Apple Health is that thing where it's a hub where we can connect. We can pull in lots of data. And you'll see in the future us asking for permissions on iPhone. And we always have to ask. We can't just pull anything. We say, hey, can we get your cycling workouts from Apple Health? What you're also going to see in the future are steps, sleep, some heart rate stuff, HRV. And why we're asking for that data, also menstrual cycle tracking, which is going to be really cool for women. We're going to pull that data in, and then we're going to use it in our ML machine learning. And it's going to be part of a bigger project to help predict how well you're going to do on workouts. And what that does is, If data comes in and has an impact on how well you're gonna do the next day on a workout, that then improves our ML model and allows adaptive training to give you better stuff. So for you could think of sleep. If you sleep 3 hours, does that impact that next day's workout? Or maybe it impacts the workout 2 days from now, right? If you have a 20,000 step day when you usually have a 1,000 step day, does that impact it? Other workouts that you do, HRV, that's a hot topic, right? Depending on when it can change, when you measure it and what company does it. But with Apple Health Kit, we can pull it in and see what company, what device did it. And we put that into our ML and see if you have if your HRV is low versus high, how does that impact that workout? And then for women, what's really cool is pulling in your menstrual cycle tracking is that we can use that against the data and see based on where you are in your cycle, how likely you are to do hard workouts versus easy workouts and how your RPE changes. How heart rate changes, all that stuff is so exciting to put these other layers in. So please, I want to say too, we never sell any data to anyone. We don't give it to anyone. The only thing that we'd push to other companies like Strava would be your cycling workout. You say specifically, push this cycling workout in Trainer Road over there. So I just want to make sure that because we're going to ask for some things that could be private for some people, that it doesn't go anywhere. And when we're using these ML models too, they're anonymous, right? The machine learning doesn't know who you are, and we just put it back into the product. So when you see that, please enable it. And then for the Apple Watch stuff, you're gonna need iOS 17 and an Apple Watch updated, and then you can use it. And John too, go ahead, Ivy.
Oh, we'll put in the description here on YouTube or wherever we can put a description where you find your podcast. We'll put the support article to how to push the outside workout to the Apple Watch. So you can find it there.
Great.
Yeah. Good call, Ivy. Yeah, super. By the way, good job, team, on building those support articles. They're like super visual and really helpful. It's awesome stuff. And I like this because, so I'm using like a Garmin watch right now, but I want to get an Apple Watch. It's a fine watch, this one, but it's a pain for being a watch, but it's good for tracking activities like backcountry skiing, but that's in it. But the cool part about this is a lot of the time, like on recovery rides, for example, like this week is a recovery week. My recovery workouts are all below 0.55 IF and they're consistent. It's 60 minutes or 90 minutes at this power range. And it's really easy to do. And I can just go outside and I'm not having a head unit on those rides, Nate. Like it's an IV. It's like a way to detox my brain from like having to be so focused. And I can just go out. I check in every once in a while. I'll glance at my wrist to see what my power is. And I just lock into what that feeling is. And soul that riding. Way I can stay really consistent. Yeah. Soul riding. Yeah, exactly. Like it gives me, it fills my emotional cup a bit. And this is really cool because now you can do it on Apple Watch. And it's funny, phone on the handlebars thing. Nate, I think you and I probably have had like a heated discussion about that in the past or something. And because the point is like, we should totally be able to have our phone on our bars. Like they're better head units than head units. Let's be real, right? There's way more capability in a phone, but we don't. And there are conveniences about a head unit for sure. But I'm starting to notice, I don't know if you've seen this, Ivy. I'm starting to notice more because originally it was just like people that would be riding like a cruiser or a townie bike might have their phone on their bars. Mm-hmm. I'm starting to notice more and more people actually having their phone on their bars. Like I was at an enduro-ish downcountry race a couple of weeks ago and I saw five people. I counted five in the enduro field of 70. Yeah. Mm-hmm. And they had their phone on a quad lock or something like that. And it was because for them, they use Strava on their phone and they're like, why in the world would I go buy a head? Yeah. Or Trail Force.
Like a trail system, right? That you don't know when you have to, that's horrible when you're in a trail system you don't know and you have to pull out your phone out every few hundred feet because you don't know which fork of the trail to take. It's miserable.
The worst. Yeah. Especially in a place like Bentonville or something where like a trail intersection every 15 feet, it feels like you just, yeah, it's hard to know. Mm. But anyways, if you're listening to this, you probably have strong opinions about putting your phone on your bars, why it's a good idea or a bad idea. I challenge you to buck convention and let us know in the comments about how you feel about it because I think in the future, that's probably just what we'll all have. Mm-hmm. It makes sense to me at least. So it is really cool. Bravo to the team working on a bunch of other stuff. It's really exciting.
I have a prediction. I predict that it will still be separate, but like the Hammerhead, it will be like an Android device, but in a different form factor. So it's more durable battery life. And it takes away some of the features of like a new iPhone can be like $2,000. You don't want to, yeah. And then you see the drop test, you drop like 5 feet and just shatters. That you might not want to do that. But to Ivy's point is that even if there are trail forks on some of these devices, the app's always better, right? It's a better experience and sure. The touch with sweat and all that. So there's certain things I think that can be better on it and weight too. But mm-hmm. I think they're merged, the Venge and the Tarmac. Be like, what's the difference? Yeah, yeah. I don't know.
yeah, exactly. Yeah. I've been using the Hammerhead recently. We have different head units here at the office. So I'm always like trying different ones. And for Hammerhead listeners, I'm sure you're like, why aren't you pushing workouts to Hammerhead yet? They're still building out some features that we want to have in place just for safety reasons for our athletes that are doing workouts outside like this. And over time, and as demand needs to increase too, like not enough people have Hammerheads too, but I already see what you're talking about, Nate, in the sense that it's running Android and it's closer to a phone. And there's a lot of really nice conveniences from that. So I could totally see it. Yeah. A lot of people are asking questions about indoor training equipment stuff, like buying a trainer, setting up your indoor setup. And it makes sense because of the time of season. So I want to cover a handful of like rapid fire questions on this. Nate and Ivy, you can jump in with your thoughts on these ones. Okay, first one. Should wheel-on trainers even be a consideration in 2023?
No.
You don't think so?
The price, that's about it.
Yeah. I think if it's what you have and it's between having a trainer and not feeling like you can do workouts indoors, especially in the winter, yeah, just keep it.
Here's the rub with wheel-on today. If you have a modern road bike with a through axle, you have to put some sort of axle weird adapter in there anyway. Mm-hmm. So you're already fussing around with the back of your bike. And I hear people say, I want to get a wheel on trainer so I don't have to worry about taking my wheel off all the time. But you wouldn't have to take your wheel off. You'd still have to take your axle out, put in the adapter. So then that way it actually has something to clamp onto because wheel on trainers need something to clamp onto. And when we had quick releases, that was easy. We don't have those anymore. It's just flush mount with your carbon frame. You'd still have to fuss about with it. And in most cases, what I've found is that like the resistance units, the smoothness, all like the good tech that you would want from a smart trainer doesn't get thrown into the wheel on trainer. It gets put into the wheel off trainer and the higher end wheel off trainers. So as a result, you're buying, if you get wheel off or wheel on, hopefully it's like cheap because you're really buying like quite old tech in a lot of cases, like not a lot of improvements.
And you have to take in consideration the wear on the tire. And when you like those tires get square, then for me is always that safety issue too of like, how thin am I making this tire? I remember back in 2010 or something and they literally get square, right? On the back tire. And then the tires are expensive too. And then you can say, well, I got a training wheel with a trainer tire on it. But then that's even more expensive, and you're getting pretty close to the price of just a wheel off trainer.
Yeah.
Yeah, maybe if you train a lot indoors, it might be a couple tires that you burn through. And so by the time you get some through axle adapter for a wheel on trainer and a couple tires, I'm trying to look up the cost of what like a new wheel on trainer would be right now. I don't even know.
They're like $350 to $400 is what I've seen recently.
For a wheel on trainer?
Yeah.
With like a tenner?
Exactly. For a smart trainer, yeah. For a smart trainer wheel on.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. You can get other ones that are like a non-smart trainer. You can get those for a lot cheaper, close to $200. But
right.
Yeah, they're still around $400. So yeah, it's not particularly cheap.
Kicker snap is $350 and the kicker core is $700.
Hmm. Yeah. And the core is wheel off, right, Nate?
Yes.
So yeah. Yeah. Being the difference there. So yeah, it's, man, it's a... It's a tricky spot to be in for sure. And the other side, I've had friends ruin their carpet with a wheel on trainer because of the rubber that flies off of their tire. I don't know if you guys have seen like a black strip, because your tire gets worn out and really hot. And some of those rollers can be abrasive, and it can get to the point where it just like sprays like a black line underneath, and rubber just accumulates and it can mess things up. So
you can do that with a dirty drivetrain too. I remember I oiled my drivetrain before and it was dirty, and then the grease flew out to the on the mat, but also the carpet in the wall. My ex-wife was not happy. So
yeah,
watch out for that. Yeah. I think the trainer mat is definitely worth it. Unless you're on concrete, like in a garage, I highly recommend that.
Between sweat and, and grease and drink mix and everything else that's going to drip on there. Yeah.
For this is why I'm afraid of apartments and houses with carpets, because what are people doing with their carpet? Just doing workouts, sweating.
Spilling coffee.
Yeah, exactly. And I'm sure somebody's going to ask, what trainer do you recommend? And honestly, so I've been over the past little bit, I've ridden Elite's high-end trainers. I've ridden Tax's high-end trainer. I've ridden Wahoo's high-end trainer. Effectively, it's like the same experience for me. And Saris is high-end trainer. They're very good. Like you buy, if you go for the top of the line on any of the notable brands, it's going to be a really good experience. So
I was going to encourage you to ride indoors. What's going to make it feel easy and convenient to just get on the bike and do your workout. If it's going to be a pain in the butt to do something that's wheel on or wheel off, and you feel like it's an extra whole bunch of steps to take your wheel off and get your bike set up, and it might deter you from doing your workout, it's maybe not the right trainer.
Said. Okay, next one. Will using my full suspension mountain bike on the smart trainer damage it? Do you want me to take this one?
Yeah.
It won't, unless like you have something that's like going up against the frame and it's a wheel on. But as far as the pivots and the suspension and everything else, no. Think about all of the abuse your bike takes when you ride it down like a hard trail. Having it locked into the trainer, even locked out, that's not going to mess it up. It's not going to mess up bearings and pivots. What would mess that up is if they're totally dry and you don't have any grease, or the pivots are already worn out and the bushings are worn out, of course, but that's not the indoor trainer. It's totally fine. So you don't have to worry about it. What fan do you recommend? There's another question that we got. The Lasco Performance Series, I think all of us use those ones, right?
It's insane.
Darn good.
You get other, y'all think you have a fan that's like with the blades, and this is like a floor cleaning or drying fan, and it's completely different. I highly recommend it. And it can, if you have a big difference in power output between outside and inside, and that you're sweating inside, get one of these. And if it hits your body, there'll be no sweat that does not get evaporated. I've never had a sweat drip from my body where this fan hits.
Yeah, they're concentrated hurricanes. And there's one called the U12104. If you look up on Amazon, we'll link down below to this one. It's $59 for a fan. So I know that sounds like a lot for a box fan, but this one's very good. There are a lot of other ones that are like 100 and above, but I have those ones. They're pretty compact, which is cool. So they can fit in a tight training space. And I have two of them. I have one that sprays on me and like my head and my torso. Then I have one that kind of sprays up from the ground across like my legs and my torso. And that is, I'm set. I'm cool.
Okay, wait a minute. I have been just using like a little, you know, like Target or Walmart fan because it's affordable. And I'm just like simplicity or minimalist girl. And I'm like, I don't want to have anything that's single use. So it's like the same fan that I use for white noise or to cool my bedroom down at night is I'll just move it over to where I'm training. But I could use this one to cool my house too, if it's that powerful. Oh,
yeah. Yes.
Ivy, that's awesome.
Tori will ship one to you today. And you'll probably get it this weekend. Yeah, just ask her, okay? You need this.
Okay.
This is equipment for work.
That's awesome. Thanks.
How many of the hosts use rocker plates is another question. That's like the, or motion plates, or they call it, describe them in a lot of ways.
Have you tried one? So much. I've tried to want it so bad. And it actually, what it did for me is it like, cause it goes back and forth as you ride, and I weigh 190 pounds, 200 pounds. And it was the momentum. Let's see, the inertia, as you go back and you go forward, the plate moves first and then my body slides and then goes back. So what happens is my body rubs back and forth on the saddle at each end of the oscillation. And it gave me like pretty bad saddle sores. And it was not, I had this like dream of, wow, the trainer's going to be comfortable for 2 hour rides. It didn't happen. I would spend that money on a nice saddle.
Yes. Don't, in my opinion, don't buy rocker plates or don't buy trainers that have built in rocker plates if that's going to cost you a lot more money. Most of them, if it's built into the trainer, has an option to lock it. And most athletes I know that have those trainers, they just lock it out because they don't want, it's not natural. I think that the premise is that it will feel more natural, but it just doesn't feel natural. It feels like your trainer's moving around underneath you. And that's a weird feeling that doesn't replicate any sort of benefit that you get from a natural ride. In my opinion, at least. Yeah. Okay. Next one. Which trainer desk do you recommend? There's, go on Amazon. If you're going to get a cycling training specific one and search up a trainer desk, you can get some for cheap that will get the job done. I have in my garage, I'm converting over to just like small floating shelves that are like 10, 15 bucks from Target. Like it's super cheap because I'm up against a wall. And that way I have those in place and I don't have a kind of like a big bulky trainer desk in the way. Cause for me, that's the barrier is having that something big and bulky, but if you want one, Amazon, but otherwise I just get some cheap shelves, man. It works pretty well.
These questions make me sound so janky and it's probably because I am. My trainer desk is like a chair with boxes on it. And then I put my computer on top of it.
You're not alone. Like whenever people send in pictures of their training setups, like ironing boards and
music stand.
Yeah, for sure. And those honestly, like a music stand or an ironing board, that's awesome. It's just as functional as what you're going to get from something else. Another person asks, how do I put my phone on my bars when they're indoor training? Lots of different options. Like you can get like phone mounts. Now the ton of people make them for bikes. If you go onto Amazon and search for something like that, there's a ton. Quad lock's really expensive, but that's a really solid option. But KOM Cycling makes a little male Garmin mount. So basically like it's got adhesive on one side, but then it's a mount on the other. And since I have an iPhone, I just put that to a MagSafe little oval or like circle thing. So then that way I just twist lock that into my bars and my phone just by magnet attaches to it. And I don't have to worry about a case or anything.
Wow. The MagSafe, so you can take the mount itself off all the time.
Totally. Okay, and then I don't have to do a different case or have something bulky on my phone all the time. Mm-hmm. That's works. Cool.
You should do a little MagSafe video on that. Cool.
Yeah, I think I should, huh?
Yeah, like a little Instagram. Would appreciate
that. Yeah. Yeah. And I think it's like $15 or $20 all in from Amazon.
Oh my goodness. Done with it. Yeah.
So pretty sweet way to do it. Okay. What shows are you watching or looking forward to watching on the indoor trainer this year?
TikTok. I'm serious. I like between hard intervals, like I will watch TikTok. And then when the interval is coming, I will put music back on and pay attention and do the interval. And then when I get to rest, I watch TikTok.
It's awesome. Nate, do you have any shows that you're looking forward to or anything?
Not really.
Or like you're watching right now?
Dropped off TV and I'm trying to think of what I don't even remember what I've watched recently.
Yeah. For me, it's the people that do Drive to Survive, that series. They also do, it's like a box to box productions or something like that. Anyways, they've done a ton on different sports. Like they've done Full Swing on golf. They've done Breakpoint on tennis. Those are fascinating to me. I like watching those a lot. Hoping new seasons of those come out. That's like what the main thing. And also GCN Plus, this is absolutely not an ad. We've even tried to work with GCN before in the past and everything else. And so this is not an ad, trust me, but it's really nice to be able to get all of your cycling like races all in one spot. And if you have a VPN, then boom, you can watch literally any race through GCN. And that's really cool. So mountain biking of all disciplines, cyclocross racing of all this, like road, it's all on there. So that's what I'll do. All right. Last one. Is indoor cycling specific kit worth it?
No,
I don't think so.
Yeah. What's the benefit? I don't understand.
They're all mesh. Like you wouldn't want to wear it out in public because it's quite see-through, but it's very mesh. And what I've found is that the mesh flexes and moves way easier than like standard bib fabric. So as a result, like your chamois, and if your bibs don't fit absolutely perfectly, you're more likely to have chamois disconnection from your body and then get saddle sores, at least what I've found. I've only used one pair of bibs like that. Gosh, which brand was it from? I can't remember. But so your mileage may vary, but I don't like mesh bibs for that same reason. Like even mesh bibs underneath mountain bike over shorts like that, I don't like it. I like normal bibs because I don't want my chamois shifting around with super stretchy bib.
I feel like you get used to them too, and having the same, if a luxury, but have six bibs of the same kind and you rotate through them, so they all wear at the same level for a season or something. Because when you switch them around, like your body gets used to one way and then you go to another bib. Whenever I switch chamois, it feels like that's when I get a saddle sore. And it's no fun.
Yeah, does that mess you up with cyclocross, Ivy? Going like to wear, because you wear your skin suit for cyclocross and then outside of that you don't.
Whoops, and I like popped some tags on some fresh ones before some races recently and I was like, oh, whoops, I should have put these through the wash or something before I did this. Yeah, it's a bummer.
Yeah. That's a pro tip, washing your stuff before you put it. I know that probably is just, that's what I do. A lot of cyclists just never wash their, they don't wash their bib shorts before they ride in them the first time. And yeah, it's a good way to have a really harsh chamois fabric and like really stiff chamois. It softens up a ton just with one wash. So, all right. Flipper's question says, Hi, this is my second season racing cyclocross, and after moving from Cat 5 to Cat 4, I'm quickly realizing that fitness plays a much smaller role in results than I had realized. As a novice with decent power, I was able to ride away from some Cat 5 fields, but this is very much not the case anymore. I'm realizing how much time I lose each lap by being bad at things like remounting my bike or not carrying speed through turns. We covered carrying speed through turns at depth with Tobin and Ivy in a previous episode. Listen three episodes back, I think 441. Talk about having the pros in-house to talk about that. Those two are really qualified for it. So check that out. One thing I can't seem to grasp the concept of is remounting my bike without losing momentum. I suffer from the crow hop that I can't seem to shake. And I even took a video of myself and watching it was horrifying. I almost came to a stop when I got to remount my bike, almost certainly losing lots of time each lap. So please help. Does Ivy or any of the other cross folks on the podcast have any advice or tips for being less bad at this? Thanks and 5 stars.
You pronounced his name. It's not Flipper. It's pronounced Nate. Like, I'm sorry you didn't realize that.
This is your burner?
Oh,
this,
no.
This is my burner. Yeah. You see this all the time, right? In races. Probably half the field lower. You're pretty good at it, but Ivy, help us all.
I have to work at it though. Like I regress. I so I haven't done it for a long time. And then I go back to get on it and I feel like I don't know what to do with my hands. Or my whole body. It's just, I don't know.
Yeah.
It's hard.
Flipper and Nate here, not alone. it's really simple in principle to think about why this is happening and how to fix it, but pretty hard to execute. And honestly takes a lot of practice once you understand why it's happening. And when you try to think about why it's happening, when you watch someone with a really bad crow hop, as Flipper calls it, or like a stutter step or skip step, people call it, you can see, maybe not everyone listening knows what this is, but when you're remounting in cyclocross, that last step that you take before you swing your leg over to remount, what this person is describing is they'll hop with that other foot that's still on the ground. And when you see someone do this, it looks like the bike is just running away from them and they're trying to catch up to it. And so when you think that's true, and that is honestly what is happening, like people that do this, when you see people do this, I can almost guarantee it's because they're thinking of remounting the bike as jumping up and landing down on the saddle. When in reality, the reason why you're skipping like that is because your momentum is going forward, right? You're running after this, running on this feature and or going over barriers and you're moving forward and your bike is moving forward. And all of a sudden you're trying to change your momentum to being up down by jumping up and landing down on your seat. And so the way to fix this is to take a really big, long last step with that leg that is doing the crow hop or the skip step. And I know that sounds easy, but that's what's happening is your left leg or the last leg on the ground is dragging behind you because you didn't take a big step. And so your body is hopping and skipping and trying to catch up with the bike and what the rest of your body is doing. And so easy fix, just practice literally just a brisk walk before doing like a run over barrier, just a brisk walk on and off the bike to do a really big last step before you swing your leg over and you won't skip. It's probably easy to do when you're just brisk walking, but then you just gradually increase the speed at which you're remounting and the length of your last step until the crow hop is gone. And it takes a lot of commitment and trust that you're going to actually land on the saddle, which is why you should start practicing with just a brisk walk and increase your speed and the length of that last step.
Would you do this before a race? Do you recommend that, or like thinking about doing drills
to,
and
like prime
music.
Yourself?
Yeah, do it off like before the race, but then if unless you're really good at it, every race before, like part of your warm up.
To like practice or remind yourself of how to do this? Oh,
yeah,
no,
some of us are really bad. I've done it before. So has John.
Yeah, for sure. Yeah, yeah.
I feel like it's just muscle memory at some degree. And that's what you're really trying to do when you do this on a practice day or a rest day, when you spend a lot of time doing this, to do that repetitive motion and know what it feels like. And then once you get it, to keep increasing your speed and keep doing it, that's when the muscle memory comes in. And I used to have to reacquaint myself with this stuff at the beginning of a cross season too. And now because I've done it so much and understand the mechanics of it and have that muscle memory, I don't need to refresh myself to remount or remember how to do it or what that feels like or have a weird buffer period of it being sloppy. It just takes a ton of repetition.
Nice. So I want to say it. So I dismount on the left side. And so if I'm running, I'm right before I'm going to get on with my left foot, I'm taking an extra big like stride. So whatever, it's going to feel awkward, right? That left foot at first, because I'm going to be, I'm going to purposely over exaggerate. Right? And I've heard too, that kind of, when you do that, you put it closer to the bike too. You're not just, is that right? So if my left foot is usually is like right in front of me, maybe I'll bring it in about 6 inches closer to that front wheel to get so that I'm closer on the hop up. Or is that right or not?
Yeah.
If you're too close, you'd hit the pedal, right? I think you would.
Right. And so I would just focus on.
My shin just
gone. Shin is gone.
Everybody's shin just hurt right now. Listening to that. Yeah.
It'd be your thigh, but I mean, your calf, but yeah.
Yeah. And the commitment that it takes to really trust how to land on your saddle and that you're going to make it. I feel like focusing on that, the length of that big last step, I don't know. The proximity to you and your bike, like laterally, how close you are, I feel like that happens slowly over time. When you just start practicing slowly, it feels like something that's high risk and high consequence. When you maybe just are starting and just go full run and try to remount, that's when you are thinking really critically about, oh my gosh, how close am I to the bike? How close do I need to be? Is it better to be this close? But when you start so slowly and do like just a brisk walk, you really learn intuitively where the saddle is, and that stuff becomes second nature. This really just takes practice.
I have a theory that all of us who do the crow hop, we don't ever practice. We only practice in races, and we never take like that 30 minutes. And I like to hear in the comments of the people that are good at it, how did you get good at it? How did you practice it to get good at it? Or was it in races? And the people who aren't good at it, are you just doing it in races? Like we are maybe like right before, or you do it like maybe so, 3 or 4 times, you get it that time. You're like, oh, I did it twice in a row. Let's go race.
I'm set.
Yeah. It's in race day, the speed and the pressure and the tiredness. And that like when you're tired and you're out of gas, cyclocross is so hard. That extra step is actually hard to do. You don't want to do it.
You revert to habits when stress and everything else raises higher. So we like revert to what our base programming is. And so if you just did it, like you said, Nate, like I'll do it in a couple of times, I'll be like, ooh, there it is. I got it. Mm-hmm. Cool. We're done. That's not a habit. That's not my base. Yeah, exactly. So it makes it a lot tougher to do it when, in the moment like that. I remember watching a video, I think it was last year, of Celine Del Carmen Alvarado, and she was at one of the World Cups, and it looked like it was like in practice, like she was reconning the course. And I remember if you were to slice from like her torso up to upward toward her head and everything else, you almost couldn't tell that she remounted her bike. Like it was so, they're so smooth, and it was just such second nature that when the leg swung over, it swung over perfectly onto the pedal, and the pedal was there to catch, and it just moved right in. I want to feel that on a cyclocross remount. It's just because this is a good point. Losing momentum. Ivy, you talked about that short foot. And then when you stutter step, you're halting your momentum. You're literally like stopping yourself, dropping to zero for a fraction of a second. And then when your leg swings over, it might add some inertia to move yourself forward, but you have stopped at all. But that's like the biggest difference that I see is there is no stop in momentum. And my gosh, that would be, I think anybody that's raced cyclocross and has been like at their limit, how nice would it be to just to have something be a slightly easier every single lap? That's it would mean everything to you in the moment in the race.
Two, how much, you got to save a second or two each time you dismount and mount.
Yeah.
And that could be what, 5 times a lap? That's 10 seconds a lap. Mm-hmm. And then you take a minute off, right? During the race or more. That is huge. A minute is many places, and at least for me,
What's more significant is that than that is maintaining a bunch of momentum when you're really hauling and running and can remount fluidly and be in a bigger gear before you dismount and run over the feature and stay in that bigger gear and not have to do a massive acceleration once you get on the bike is huge. To feel like you're just maintaining speed through a feature instead of slowing down and having to get back on top of the gear and out of the saddle once you remount saves so many matches, saves so much energy.
Mm-hmm. I have another idea for Instagram for a little video. I think it'd be great if we have some footage of you doing some things that are good and you just do a little, we used to do the race analysis. It's just like a 30-second one or something with some tips about what you did, and we can do a little slow-mo and why people can do it on these things. Because I think it's great that we hear you say it, but I would love to see you do it at the same time. That would be amazing. Mm-hmm. And John, you too, for mountain biking. You too, Bobby, for mountain biking. Yeah. You guys for everything. That's going to be John.
That'd be fun. Yeah, yeah.
If we have a crow hop of John too, internet would love to see that.
It's okay, John.
It's true.
Free month to anyone who gets a video.
I can do that.
Free month to anyone who gets a video of John crow hopping.
He's out.
If it makes you feel better, I did the crow hop so severely for the first, I think, like season and a half that I raced cross, and I was finally, this is embarrassing, this is enough, and went to a park like 2 days a week for a few weeks and just worked on it. You can do it. I believe in you.
Can people let us know in the comments on YouTube if there is something we've described that would be really helpful if we could describe it with video connected, like the cornering. There's so many things that we've described, descending, sprinting. We have a sprinting video we could even cut up too. That would be great if you give us some ideas, because when we have ideas like that and people upvote them, the ones that you, we just have a list of things of work items to go through.
Yeah. Yeah. It'd be awesome. Jolt's question and Jolt's question here. This is very much one of those situations where I'd be like, man, I get what it's like to have terrible hair. Meanwhile, and assume I have terrible hair, be like, but I'm not one of those people. So this is one of those situations. Jolt says, I've been using Trainer Road for more than 2 years and absolutely love it. Since then, I also started to race mountain bikes, about 1.5 to 2 hour cross-country marathon style races and some fun cyclocross in the winter. During the races, I noticed that I'm somehow unable to push the watts on the flats and false flats as on the climbs. I understand that this is somewhat normal and expected, but compared to other riders, I clearly don't excel in these parts of the races. This is that situation right there where it's like, I get that this is normal, but I'm not in a normal case. So just this weekend, I had a race where there were lots of false flats and flat parts, and I had trouble keeping up with some riders or opening gaps. But I managed to drop in gaps the same riders quite easily on the climbs. My FTP is currently 305 watts for 77 kilograms at 170 pounds. So feel free to check my Trainer Road calendar if that helps with the question. I'm going to cut it off there. He has some more information, but the relevant question there is, so I'm able to drop these people on the climbs. Why isn't it happening when we get to the flats and everything else? Why is everybody else relatively stronger than I am in those situations? And this is like, we've all faced this, I'm sure.
I wonder too, that I see two things here. One is, are you actually putting out less watts on the flats, which does happen. We can talk about that. But also, even on a false flat, aerodynamics on mountain biking are huge. And opening up gaps, and if there is a gap, people can pull away from you because of if they're drafting. And the 305, 77, 170 pounds, there's probably riders that are smaller than you with more aerodynamics. And with mountain biking too, some people are like straight up, like Keegan, mm-hmm. but he's obviously does pretty well with it.
He's aero now. Aero is he? Eagles. Yeah, yeah.
Oh, my
goodness. Oh, it's crazy. Yeah.
You're never going to lose again. Yeah. But you want,
it's actually been the story of the year. Yeah.
Which one do you want to talk about? False flats first? Which one? Go ahead.
I want to talk about like the assumption in our mind that I can push hard on the climbs and that matters a lot. Like, it doesn't matter that much. Like, everybody can push hard on climbs. And I was just, Derek Teal from Dialed Health had this crazy ride, 320 miles and over the same elevation of Everest that he was doing this weekend, and from Sacramento up to our region and then back down. Whoa. And I laid out this pacing plan.
No.
And this pacing, yeah, it's pretty crazy.
So Sacramento to Reno then back, or to Tahoe? Like
Sacramento to Truckee to North Lake Tahoe, up and over Mount Rose to Geiger, then down to Gardnerville and up Kingsbury, then over to Kirkwood, and from Kirkwood to Placerville, and then home.
So all those names, insane. He said, one of those climbs at the end would be a great workout. Like Geiger.
Yeah, it's one of those climbs is like one of the big climbs you'd see in the tour. And these are like, there's 11 of them in this ride. So gnarly day. Anyways, he did this thing and he wanted me to lay out a pacing plan. So I got a bunch of information on him, built out this pacing plan. And I was like, I think you can do it in 18 hours and 10 minutes. You would have 185 watts for your average power and 195 for your normalized power. He did have an unanticipated rough gravel section coming up from Sacramento to Tahoe. But all that said, he was way behind schedule and continued to just trickle further and further behind schedule. I joined him from North Lake Tahoe and then all the way wrapped around lots of riding and ended up in South Lake Tahoe with him. And he was not following the pacing plan. And I want to just share this really quick. So there's something called your variability index. Nate, can you describe variability index for people? Yeah, it's like a metric that people use.
It's the difference. Joel Friel came up with it. And it's the difference between your normalized power and your average power. And what it was used for is in triathlon, to try to tell triathletes, you're being too variable. Like you're not being steady. Because in a triathlon, the steady state power on most courses, not all courses, wins. And a one variability index of one means that your average power and normalized power are equal. There's no such thing as a negative variability power because you can't have your normalized power. There's some interval cases, but it's very small. It's 2 watts, but don't think about that.
Yep. In this case, I did a variability index of 1.06, which is like pretty darn stable. And that's 185 watts average and 195 normalized. And that would have given him 18 hours and 10 minutes. Now I changed the variability in this case to 1.46. So that's like typically what you would see if you were doing like a criterium, like something like that,
huge,
like big surges. Okay. When you do that, the normalized power is within 2 watts. It's 194 watts instead of 196 watts. Okay. But then the average power drops to 132 watts. And what this looks like is on the climbs, you're going way harder. And then on false flats, on descents, on flat sections, you're going way easier. That's what this looks like. Okay. So in other words, it's how we all naturally ride before we start to pay attention to this stuff. Everybody goes hard at the bottom of every climb. Everyone does that. And then everybody eases up when the gradient eases up. And if it doesn't ease up, everybody gets a lot slower because you shot your shot. You have no more matches, right? For that moment, at least, when you've gone too hard at the bottom of a climb. Guess what the time difference is between those things? Remember, same, effectively the same normalized power. And it's 20 hours and 25 minutes versus 18 hours and 10 minutes. So that's 12% slower just by allowing your power to vary. This is like really important for cyclists to keep in mind. It's not faster to surge hard at the bottom of a climb, even though it feels like you're going hard. So that must be fast in your mind. It's not. Stay stable and then keep the power on as you go over the tops of climbs. You can let your power drop a bit when the gradient drops down and it gets into downhills and flats. But you are not coasting. You're staying even with your power. So the reason that you feel like you can drop them might be because they are being smart about their pacing.
Ooh.
And if they're being smart about their pacing, they're playing chess while you're playing checkers. Like you're sitting here going, ha, I can drop you on the climbs. And they're like, go ahead, dude, wear yourself out. I'm going to be even power and I'm going to be way faster. So that's my thought on this.
There are times though in races where you would want to, if there's a group in the long climb, you want a separation so that you can, or there's, we want to be with a group for aerodynamics and that sort of thing. But in general, mm-hmm. especially too, if you're not at the front of the race, I think like Keegan, he attacks on Columbine, right? To get a separation on purpose. But if you're not at the front of the race, usually in where I am, there's so many people that there's always someone to draft. And if you just ride your pace, it's much more likely to get onto a train that's the right level as you. When you go too hard, you're going to train or you're just going to, it's going to burn you up and you can't, like you're going to go slower in the long run.
Yeah. I agree with that. Ivy, what are your thoughts? Because you've raced like road and cyclocross, like you've done polar opposites with this.
Yeah. And I think reading this question, and this is not a slam on this rider at all, I would just be really surprised if this person having raced for less than 2 years really would understand the nuances of when is the right time to go, when is the right time to exert your power to. And so I didn't even need to look at this athlete's calendar or know their FTP or look at their numbers on a false flat versus a climb or anything. I just think that they're fixating on why was the outcome of the race this way? Why couldn't I control it in this way when I can control the outcome in these circumstances? And I just feel like this is a thing that you learn pretty early on in racing, trying to control the outcome of any of these scenarios in a race is totally a fool's errand. Like you have no idea how deep other people you're racing with are willing to dig in certain moments that are more consequential than others. And there's a chance that they know that it's a more consequential moment than maybe you understand. And so This race scenario is not a good opportunity to look at your strengths as a rider and be like, where am I falling short? Why are my fitness weaknesses as such? This is not a good way to measure where you need to build your fitness, because you can drop people in some race scenarios and not in others, you know?
I wonder how much of this just comes from the fact that we watch bike racing and we're watching the world's best run a race of attrition, where typically big climbs in the Tour always comes to mind. And it's like a team is like holding stable power. And then after that, once the pace is just ratcheting up and up, it gets to the point where there's only a couple more cyclists left. And in our mind, we see that as bam, they're really attacking each other, going super hard on the climb. So thus in a race, that's what I need to do. And that's like what forms our view of how we should bike race. But in the end, like Nate said, if you're one of the leaders that's like fighting for position, then you are going to have to make those sort of digs. If you're not one of those leaders that's fighting for position, and maybe if you have crazy headwinds and you don't want to be alone, that's one thing, you got to stay with groups. But in a lot of other cases, I would say a majority of cases, it's better to just pace evenly. It's going to pay off. You're going to go faster by the end of that race.
You know? And fighting for single track too. That's huge if you're a good descender. I'm the opposite. Sometimes I'll let people go first because I don't want to have that pressure and or have to pull over in the middle. That's even slower. So I'm going to, Jolt. Yeah. I'm going to be a lot.
According to the internet, I might be wrong, Jolt. I'm sorry. Okay. I looked it up and that's what it said.
let's ignore the kind of stuff that y'all said. And let's just imagine that they do just have trouble putting out the exact same watts in the climb versus the flats. Because that's a thing. And the reason, there's a few reasons why this could be. And I think as a beginner rider, I always have this issue too. One, when you're on a climb, you get that instant feedback that you're going slower. And when you start, when you put out less watts, you slow down really fast. Versus the flat, you, even a false flat, you put out like 10, 20% less power, you still coast and you don't notice that you start slowing down. You have to really look at that power and get that feedback. Two, when you're on that climb.
That's a really good point.
Yeah. Where the pedal stroke is hard is that like that first and second quadrant of the pedal stroke. And you, again, you get a lot of feedback there. And on the flats, when you push through that, it's a little bit easier to go through. And you might need to be on a bigger gear on the flats to simulate that more, what it's like with climbing. So I would try that.
Resistance, right? Yeah. Because like where if you ease up on the pedals, it's you have to put out pressure on the pedals throughout 360 degrees of the pedal stroke. Whereas when you're not going on a hill, you don't have to.
And you don't necessarily have to do that to have that experience, but to go fast. But if you find that is a limiter, I would try that and see if you need that feedback. Yavi?
I see people say this who only do intervals or structure training on climbs. And then they get to a really high pace, flat race. And it's like they're trying to recruit muscles they've never used before or create that tension on the cranks that you're describing, Nate, like that they've never tried to do before because they just want to do intervals on climbs because it's easier.
And if I was to pick an environment, if I had to pick one, this is unrealistic, but if I had to pick one, only train on the flats or only train on the climbs, I would train on the flats because I feel like anybody can put out power on the climbs. Like it's more common. That's easy for everybody. Whereas putting out power, that same power on the flats is more commonly hard for everybody. And if you can do it in the flats, it's crazy how like relatively easy it feels when you're doing it on the climbs. There really is like something to that constant pressure that you need to put out.
If I had to choose one, I'd pick the trainer. I don't know about you guys, but.
Well, and on the trainer, it's gearing, right? That's how you, you emulate it.
So my next point is on the trainer, you said you're using TR, I don't know if it's inside or outside, but I would do a smaller gear on the trainer. So you have a faster cadence. And in those intervals, especially threshold intervals, some VO2 max intervals, try like a higher cadence around 100, 110. And what that will do is on the trainer, you won't have that. It will feel more fluid and maybe that'll help your pedal stroke on there. And as long as you keep your cadence up on that situation, you'll kind of get used to that. Next one is hip angle. A lot of people don't think about on those steep climbs, especially mountain biking, your hip angle naturally opens up because you're leaning back. And that can be a huge thing for triathletes, for anyone, right? And especially for me with my long femurs, hip angle is a huge limiter for me. And then when you're on the flats, you might be hunching down an arrow, getting lower, effectively doing a time trial position. And that will then also make that part harder to put out. So the way to get around it is you train with specificity and you do either train on the flats with some arrow position or on the trainer, you put in that arrow position. Another way to test that would be indoors, you can put a block underneath your wheel, do an interval with your wheel pretty high, like you would on a climb. And you can even use your iPhone on the handlebars to see the, like what the elevation is with the measure app. And
the
then,
grade,
yeah, what the grade would be. And then on, then do it again with the flat. And I think what you might see is that because of hip angle, like because in this situation, the resistance is the same, right? There's no hill that you're pushing against. It's just the trainer. But you probably will find that with the steeper one, the hip angle open, it will be easier. And to get around that, because racing is not just climbs, as we've heard here, is do more with flat stuff and train more there. You might be a bike position issue. I've had luck with raising your saddle and pushing it forward a little bit. That opens your hip angle up a little bit. You might have to raise your bars though if you do that. And bike fit is such a hard thing, and it's really hard to describe over here, and I don't want to do a video on
bike fitting over podcast. Works great.
Yeah exactly.
perfect medium for it. Yeah. So that's really good. Those are really good points, Nate.
Yeah, so I'm gonna say it's actually happening to you. It's not in your head, but this happened to me when I started riding too. And then on the opposite though, once you get good at it, especially like you're a little bit bigger rider, you put power on the flats and other people can't. Ooh. You hit that separation, then see you later, you're gone.
Yeah, take that power that you're putting out on those climbs to drop people, save it, and start using it over the top of the climb and into the descents, and then you're going to really influence races and change up how they happen. And yeah, I used to suck at this too. I bet everybody listening to this that's like an experienced cyclist is, yeah, I was really bad at this too. But it is something, like Ivy said, that over time you're going to build and you'll get better at, as long as you're putting in concerted efforts to work on it. So
the two,
Nate,
other,
you mentioned fighting into single. Oh, go ahead.
I see two other analogies on this. Is one is, remember that, like when you climb with somebody and they're a little bit faster than you and you try to go a little bit slower, but you can't because they're with you, and suddenly you put out more power, right? That happens mm-hmm. all the time. And we're in a group race, right? In a race, because you have that feedback when you slow down instantly that there's, oh wow, there's 2 inches gone. And you're like, nope, I'm going to do it. Mm-hmm. The other one is on the trainer. When you first, if you've not used erg mode and you ever try to do it and you look away for 10 seconds and then you realize that, oh wow, power has dropped if it's a really hard interval. But when you use erg mode, you're stuck there. That's why we really like erg mode. I think all the trainers, if you don't have an erg mode trainer, like I highly recommend upgrading to one of those. That's where it locks you in, as you, no matter what your gearing or cadence is, you're going to put out the same power. It's like the same analogy of that where, yeah, it locks you in, and those kind of things outside that make it give you that extra motivation to keep that power up are inside too. Like you don't get to, mm-hmm. not the motivation, but you just can't slow down.
Yeah. And try playing with something on this too. In the middle of your interval, when you're using erg mode, be in the normal gear that you're in. And then every once in a while, as long as it doesn't compromise the quality of your workout, shift to a different gear and feel if it feels a bit different because of the inertia of the flywheel and everything else. And that's the sort of small little details that you can incorporate into your training that can help with this. So Nate, you mentioned fighting for position into single track. That's the next question from Reese. Reese says, big fan, you encouraged me to give racing a shot, and it's been exactly what I needed to satisfy my competitive urges. I just finished the last local mountain bike race of the season, and I went from getting last to battling for top fives by the end of the year. Ooh. And I credit you with that improvement. Nice work. Yeah. Your tips on race execution were invaluable and played in my head during every race. However, as the season went on and I got faster, I kept running into the same problem. Our races start on a paved road with a slight climb before taking a hard left off the road into tight single track for almost the entire 15-minute loop, then back onto the pavement and repeat for a total of 5 times. My issue is the fight for single track. I've gotten much better on single track and in slick conditions, but I find myself unable to use those skills, and I'm caught behind 25 riders on the first lap. It's really frustrating. And once riders get onto the single track, they seem to sit up and chill. And I bet when they get back onto the paved section, they jam it and they go really hard too. It's like really frustrating for sure.
I wonder if they now, are chilling or if Reese is just that much better at riding single track that mm-hmm. they're just like, oh, they're going slow now.
Good point. Because if you think that they're chilling, it's probably going to make you more frustrated and flustered in the race. Mm-hmm. Whereas if you just respect that this is where their abilities lie, that might make you not so upset. Mm-hmm. Really good point, Ivy. Now, I know you're probably thinking I should just pedal harder and fight for better position, but yes. The guy that wins every week almost always gets caught behind the same scrum like me on the first lap, but he seems to just get stronger as the race goes on. So is there such a thing as a race strategy where not fighting for position into the single track is a good idea? And if so, how do I know when to use it?
No. I don't know. I would. I can see wanting to work on how to safely move through a field and pass riders on single track, I can see that being a skill you'd want to have. But as a race strategy, I can't think of any.
I want to say, too, this rider who gets stronger as the race goes on and beats them, they could honestly be just a watt per kg higher than everyone. And so don't, just because they do this doesn't mean it's because they win. It could be in spite of their fitness, like they can still win.
Mm-hmm. They might be making it, like they're 2 watt kg above and they're making it fun for themselves. You know what I mean? Like, mm-hmm. Yeah. And so they're on purpose doing a bad strategy, maybe just because it makes it more fun.
Do you really think that? Come on.
Look, man, some people are like, I'm thinking locally of like Justin Thomas, a really fast cyclist. We've talked to him before on the podcast. He's multi-time national champion, Xterra podium, pro podium, like world championships, like legit athlete. And when he shows up to our local races, sometimes I feel bad for him. Like he must be bored. Or Lucas Myers is another, he's a junior who's now not, he's actually, good luck, Lucas. He's got selected to represent Team USA at Snowshoe World Cup. Really exciting for one of our junior Devo athletes to get that. But when he shows up to race, he's bored, man. Like I come across second usually and he's not even breathing hard and he's at the finish line. He's changed out of his clothes and it's a short track race. And like, it might be boring for him. I don't know. It could be the case, but probably not likely.
Fun fact, if you Google what to do when you get caught with two to go, you can see me beating Justin by a quarter tire in a crit.
Claims to fame.
Anything, it's because of what, there weren't any hills. It was like a 2 second hill. And if there was any hills, he would destroy me by, I don't know, an hour, on an hour.
Justin's awesome.
Yeah, it's really good.
Yeah, so my thought on this one is the only time where it might make sense not to get caught up in this fight for single track is if it's a race where you will have a lot of other passing opportunities throughout the rest of the race and you anticipate people will get tired. I did this at single track 6 to a certain extent on some of the stages because I figured the day is really long. There's like fire road sections that are really long. We'll get to sort out. And I didn't fight for every single position, but it's all about passing opportunities to me. And if you think that fight for single track is going to blow people up and you can take advantage of that, but it's always a risk if you do that. Like you're always risking something because you get caught behind somebody and there's a big pile up or something and it makes you crash, you're stuck. And it's not just you're stuck, you might be hurt. So there's a difference between slowing down in terms of and losing time, but there's also the opportunity of crashing and having a mechanical or hurting yourself. And when you fight for single track, you remove those potential liabilities from existing. It's an insurance plan, basically. You have to weigh all of those options. Like it could be that case, but I don't know. In this case, in a lapped course, you got to fight for it. Like you got a race, I would think, Nate, you did those Folsom races and I feel like they had pinch points where you had to fight for this. How did you get to the point where you got comfortable fighting for position?
Yeah, that one is an interesting race where at the beginning, people go so hard at the beginning and it's open. There's some turns and I'm literally in last place or second last place. But then there is a like this long stretch that has like a crosswind on a little like dam thing that's maybe like a quarter mile. And I would get to first, second position. Right there, I just go by everybody. Like everyone would just line up and I would just pass them. And that would help so much to then when we went into single track, I was in second or third. And you would hear sometimes too, someone behind take a turn poorly, screech, everyone like cuss. And I would just be like laughing in my head another like 10 seconds. Because the further back you are, usually the worse the skills are. And then you get more fuel effect. You have to use the brakes more. Where then if you're up at the top and or up at the front, it is so much easier. I think for you two, I think people don't realize if you go in a single track early, how hard do you actually go?
Oh, so hard.
It's all out, John, right? Like
you risk your race, right, Ivy?
Yeah.
Like for cyclocross and stuff, you start as if you aren't thinking about the fact that you have 45 minutes to race.
No.
You're like, I'm just racing to that corner.
It feels so ballistic. Like it's horrible. It's almost like, it's almost duplicatable in training for me. Like I cannot emphasize how when you decide to go in all in for a start and race to a first feature, you really are risking the rest of the race. But the reality is every single other person is too. If they're
not
going
everyone.
Just
yeah,
as hard.
Going hard. It's like the opposite of the last question, right? Where we're like even pacing, do this because of the positioning. And I think too, Therese, when people say they just seem to chill, it's because they just got in position. And now they are recovering.
Blown.
Yeah, but they're recovering for a while though. And then they'll push harder later. And Reese, because you say you're top five, but you're 25 behind, like going in single track, I just don't think Reese is issue with either lining up in a correct place for Reese. And if top five, you should be in the front row. Or two, clip-ins, like getting the right gear. You two should talk about this, how fast they start. And then that early on sprint. Can you talk about those three things, please?
Starts would be great, Ivy, because how do you select your gear? I've seen a couple different ways to do that. But for cyclocross, it's even more important because you're more traction limited than even a mountain bike.
And it depends also upon, like, sometimes they'll stage you in grass and a pile of gravel. I usually
gravel
do.
Gravel starts are so such a pain. Chip seal, where it's just like a bunch of ground up asphalt or something.
Yeah. When that does happen, after they call us up and we're all lined up, I'll use my rear tire to scoot a little path in the gravel for the rear tire so that once I clip in and get going, I'm not like peeling out on gravel. But I usually do.
Can you say that more? Because that's important. So you're clearing, like you're pushing the ground so there's no gravel, there's just dirt below your tire so that you don't spin out. That's such a cool pro tip.
Hand on the front brake so that my bike isn't moving. And then just with my 1 foot clipped in, so I'm just picking up the bike with my crank and just scooting the rear tire left and right to clear a little path, clear the gravel away from my tire so that once the race starts and I'm clipped in, I don't lose a bunch of traction because I'm trying to start hard on a pile of gravel.
Do you ever clear out forward of your rear tire as well, like up to your front tire or even beyond? Yep. I don't know if there's a UCI rule against that. That'd be interesting.
It's just like a path, a trail for Ivy.
Actually,
like if there's no rule against it.
Yeah. This is a secret trick.
Don't tell anyone.
This is a free podcast. They're getting value. Yeah.
It's a circle of trust here.
So after they call us up and we're tight and we're waiting and we get the minute or 30 seconds, I actually roll back a little bit as much as half a tire length, because there's that moment when we start and we're trying to get in our pedals and there's like an initial, when you get on the bike, a surge, and then it like slows down before you get out of the saddle and start really starting. And so if you're really close to the person in front of you and you start and you have a good start and a bunch of momentum, you have to stop or hit the brakes sometimes if the person in front of you doesn't have as good of a start. So I will scoot back and create a little space so that I can start and just get rolling, even if the person in front of me fumbles it a little bit. Anyways.
In motocross, we could pat down and walk ahead of the gate, depending on the race. And you would, like, I would send my dad ahead of me and he'd be stomping with heavy boots as hard as he possibly could to have a line that was like compacted in front of me. And it made a huge difference.
Like, awesome.
And for mountain biking, I have absolutely been in front of my bike before and clearing out with my foot rocks and that sort of thing. So not even just from the back tire to the front tire, but even ahead of that, you just have to, I guess, if I don't know if that's against the rules, I've never been called out on it, but that it matters for sure. Maybe. Yeah, how about gear selection though? How do you pick the right gear? That can sink your ship. You can have everything in great position, but then that ruins it.
Yeah. There's a gear that I know that all, if it's just a really straightforward flat start, but you should practice like a false start, like practice it in your pre-ride, or it's embarrassing. It's super embarrassing to go stand on the start line and practice clipping in and doing a really hard start. But I like it. It gets the cobwebs out and it makes you make sure that you understand if the start is really bumpy or something, or if you start climbing right away, that it just helps you practice and know which gear you actually want to be in and if it feels good.
Yeah, we should normalize that, because I think that I've seen Haley Hunter Smith. Mm-hmm. She does that. I remember I've seen it at a handful of races, like cross country Olympic races, and tons of top athletes I see in cross country Olympic. They'll practice starts like that before the race, and they're trying to find the right gear. They're trying to find the right position, the right surface, because from one rider, like from 1 foot to the next, the surface might change and you might want to figure it out. And I don't know what cog I go into for a start. I don't have, it's the fourth cog down or something like that. I just go there to wherever the start is. And I feel out what it's like to roll, and then I test it out and I see what it's like. If I have to grab a ton of gears when I start, that's bad. Mm-hmm. If I'm to the point where I feel like I'm standing on top of something and barely turning over the gear, it's also bad because I'm going to lose traction. So like I try to find one where I'm going to clip in, and like I'll have enough time to be able to get my other foot clipped in before I have to grab another gear in a race. Is that accurate for what you do too, Ivy?
Yeah, totally. And I would say that like being in a gear that's so easy because you want to not be super bogged down. If you have to dump a bunch of gears in the first few seconds is not the right start gear.
Yeah. Because you have to ease up every time you shift like that. Or I guess if you have a transmission, you don't have to, which is pretty cool. That would be sweet on cyclocross bikes because that one's designed to shift better under load. Maybe, that would be pretty sweet.
Maybe this is a mentality thing for Reese too, not necessarily a mechanics of, am I in the right gear? Am I getting my pedal fast enough? All of that. Maybe it starts with a bunch of people or stressful, and it takes a really specific mindset to be willing to like battle folks out there in the first few moments of a bike race.
Yeah. Oh, and I think that maybe the best tip for handling that and even just handling starts in general is you probably know in this case, Reese, who is going to get the whole shot, who's going to be the first into the turn. It's probably consistently one of three or five people. Line up behind them and then just make sure that you stay on that wheel. And that's the wheel that you hold. And you don't think about anything else other than just holding that wheel. That can remove a whole lot of the decisions about what you need to do. And instead you're just following them, makes it easier. And if you're behind them, that means you're going to be in a better start position. Hopefully you're in a situation where you're not riding checks that are going to bounce later on. But honestly, you need to do that at times in races, especially these local races. Like, you do need to cross the line and blow yourself up, because then you'll figure out where the line is and how far you can push it. Because if you're afraid of blowing up on a start, you're going to hold back too much and you're always going to be too far back.
Reese, I'd try some small steps on this. So if you're coming in 25th, try 20th or 15th, have that be your goal. And you can feel, because you could blow yourself up and you probably won't get the whole shot. But if you move from 25th to 15th, let's see what happens with your race. I bet you'll do a lot better. And then 15th, then go try to go to top 10, then a top five. And maybe top five is plenty for you. Like, you don't have to get the whole shot to win the race, but top five, you're probably not going to be slowed down on single track by the other four people ahead of you, which is that, I think that's the real key, is that you don't lose so much time in the single track that you can't make up later on the flats.
Yeah. Agreed. Can we get into Shelley's question?
Okay.
That's a good one. Shelley says, what's the deal with greens powders? Should I let myself be influenced by my favorite cycling athletes and give them a try, or are they worth the hype and cost? Thanks for all you do. Shelley, I've had this same question so many times. IVA.
I want to believe. If
you have to. No, I just, but for real, don't, as someone that has sponsors and posts about them, when I see other athletes post, I'm very lucky that the sponsors that I have, I like, and I actually use and would choose them otherwise. But it's so funny to know those athletes that have sponsors and post about that, and then behind closed doors they're like, man, I don't like that. Like, I'm just trying to secure the bag. I just gotta post about it. And so don't think that because an influencer or an athlete is posting about something that they actually believe in it. So it is
very crazy. This is inside industry stuff. And we don't have sponsors, but yeah. We didn't say anything. Yeah, but there are people who, like Ivy said, they might be sponsored by all these things and they don't actually use them. They only say that they use them. And I know that's like the trust and stuff. And man, I'm on TikTok. So I said I didn't watch TV anymore. TikTok, still there. And I bought one thing from the TikTok shop. And now TikTok, like 75% of my stuff is from TikTok shop. And all those influencers are like, this is my favorite, blah, 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 blah. And like, they just want to sell stuff. And it's sometimes what happens is you trust somebody for so long, for years, and then they get the ability to sell you stuff. And then we're selling Trainer Road, but we've been consistent the whole time on this. Yeah, and then it's just whatever is available for them, right? Whatever company approaches them, whatever company's in the TikTok shop, whatever they can get paid the most. And they use that currency that they built up on genuine recommendations over time. And
nutrition might be the trickiest one too, particularly when you're talking about athletes, because you don't have to see them taking it. They can take in whatever they want. And you don't know what they do every morning in their morning routine, that sort of stuff. I've had this same question. I think I've had an Athletic Green subscription in my cart like 40 times probably over the past, I don't even know how many years. And I never do it. It's like $100 a month. And that's a not small amount of money. And I think that they capitalize on this guilt that all of us have that isn't totally founded. Every one of us probably feels like I could be eating better, because it's probably true to some extent. But are we missing something that this drink will give us and that will be the thing that improves our health or improves our performance? And that's the question. So I went, because of this, Shelley, you finally prompted me to do a full deep dive. And I went into every single ingredient that exists within Athletic Greens and I reviewed every single one of them. And I tried to find situations. I found studies, and then I found which ones are performance enhancing potentially and which ones were not. But before I say any of that, I just want to say, if your goal is general health, a green supplement is not going to hurt. Like, it's not going to hurt. It's going to be something that is likely going to, it might not be beneficial, but it's probably not going to hurt for you to take in this sort of thing with a whole bunch of different ingredients. If your goal is just like general health, achieve a more well-rounded diet, it'll probably do that. But in terms of it making us faster, that's the lens that I took on this and I went through it. So something to keep in mind, you'll see on the nutritional facts or the supplemental facts of this sort of thing, you'll see like the breakdown of all the different micronutrients, macronutrients, that sort of thing. And then you'll also see the ingredient list. Now, proprietary blends are these things that particularly in the supplement industry exist. And the companies, because of privacy, they don't, and they're protected by the FDA for this, they don't have to list how much of each individual ingredient is within a proprietary blend. However, they do have to list which ingredients are in that blend. But in terms of their proportion, you have no clue. So there are three main like things within this. They say an alkaline, nutrient-dense, raw superfood complex. That's the first thing, and it composes the majority of it, 7.4 grams out of each serving. Then there's a nutrient-dense extracts, herbs, and antioxidants, and that composes 2.7 grams of a serving. And then there's a digestive enzyme and super mushroom complex, which is very small. It's a fraction of a gram. And that one, and then they have probiotics at the end. So within that, there are a lot of different ingredients. And that first group of the raw superfood complex, there's 25 ingredients. I could only find studies that potentially show performance improvement for 17 of these, or for seven of these, sorry, out of all of those. So we're going to cover that. And then in the next groups, there's even less. But I want you to focus on one really important thing. 7.4 grams is in each serving, this dense raw superfood complex is only 7.4 grams. And most of these things, if you're trying to get performance improvement, require way more than 7.4 grams, but it's split up in between 25 ingredients. Now, that doesn't mean that they're equally split up so that every one of them is an equal portion. It actually likely is the fact that there's one or two that are almost all of it, and then the rest are probably like a really small portion of that. But just the same, keep that in mind. They have spirulina that makes things green, and I'll link to all the studies on this, that makes things really green. It's like a really good for making a green powder look even extra more green. And it could theoretically be an antioxidant that could support performance, but you would need 8 to 10 grams to get to the point where that would be measurable. And that's more than this 7.4 grams. That's probably not going to improve your performance. And there's studies to back that up. I'll share it. Inulin, that's a prebiotic. Again, you would need 5 to 15 grams of this to see some sort of potential improvement, but the studies are mixed. Beetroot powder, nowhere near enough beetroot powder to get the sort of benefits that you would want. There, if you take a beetroot supplement like prescribed, Alt Red or anything like that, if you're taking, that's going to be like 10, 15 times the sort of dosage that could potentially exist, but likely doesn't exist within this. So beetroot powder isn't going to be there. Cocoa bean, polyphenol extracts, this one would theoretically also be like an antioxidant that would help with inflammation, but it shows that in studies, it doesn't improve exercise performance. So that one's not the case. Grapeseed extract, same thing. They haven't even shown in performance improvement with 8 grams a day, which this one has far less than that, I would assume at this point. Green tea, that's another one that it's likely not going to show performance improvement. Studies haven't shown performance improvement with it. And then ginger rhizome powder, which is supposed to be like a painkiller, an anti-inflammatory. No performance improvement has been shown with studies with this either when you look at meta-analyses.
Like you're saying, with all this, how much ginger
could be
could
be 0.0000, who knows how much within this, or could be 7 grams. It could be the whole thing. We don't know, but that's the proprietary blend. But in short, with those ones, and then if you look at the herbs and antioxidants, same story. None of them adds up to something that would actually improve your performance on the bike. Even when you get into the mushroom complex, there's no performance benefits found for any of the ingredients within that. And then the prebiotics, this is a really interesting one. So they say that they have 7.2 billion CFU, which is like the measurement that they use for probiotics. And in studies, they haven't shown performance improvement for this, even when people are taking up to 10 billion CFUs. And here's the trickiest part with probiotics. Like we hear this, like we need to have a healthy gut microbiota, and that's the thing that we're all going for, and probiotics can do that. But what you're trying to do there is everybody's gut is so entirely different that just taking a probiotic does not guarantee that it will improve. It's a very complex thing, and trying to influence it in specific ways to improve it, we simply don't know how to improve it best. The one thing that does show that it has a more consistent across the board benefit than taking any sort of probiotic is fiber as a prebiotic effectively. And when you take in a lot of fiber, that does have a much more consistent positive effect on the gut microbiome. Now, all that said, if you were to eat all of these things in whole foods, you'd be getting a whole lot more fiber and it would likely help you more with this sort of prebiotic and probiotic effect that you're trying to go for. So I'm going to link to all these studies because I think it's important to show due diligence for this sort of stuff when you're going through. Went through a ton of them. I'll link them down below. But my assessment from the current body of research and a lot of these studies, even some of these studies, three of them have come out this week. So it's like recent research and it's meta-analyses and systematic reviews, almost all of them that I'm linking to here. It's not conclusive that any of this stuff will improve performance on the bike. But if your goal is just general health, it seems like it. Nate, you take like a, I've seen like you've had like a cereal bowl of vitamins that you've taken in the morning at different times. Yeah, do you still do that? And do you take a green supplement like this?
I've done green supplements, but I didn't notice any difference. And the supplements that I take for sports performance are none of these. And I've changed it a little bit to be more just vitamin D, magnesium, and I think that's maybe citrulline.
Do you still take creatine?
Yeah, just still.
Creatine is proven to make you faster. Boom, right there. Protein helps a lot. There is.
But the brain function, the cognitive benefits of creatine too, is especially with like concussions is what I've liked too. And I was going to do a video about this, but somebody used like mid-volume train road plan and took an hour off the race time. Wouldn't it be nice if like you could take athletic greens and take an hour off a long race? Like your performance. And what we're talking about here is that people take these and I bet you don't notice any change in your FTP. The ones that do make a change, consistency, and you get consistency through sleeping enough and eating carbs. And then the rest of this stuff is when your carbs, if you can, have them wrapped in fiber, which is going to be like vegetables, fruit, whole grains. Then you get what John said with the fiber thing. And then when you're on the bike, you eat simple carbs and then you get enough protein and maybe 1.8 to 2.2 grams per kilogram of body weight. Somewhere there, 2.2 is probably a little bit high for cyclists, but maybe 1.8. And you're pretty set. And then just don't overdo it. If you have you still should eat fat, but if you want to maintain your total caloric intake for the day, don't have more fat grams of fat than carbs or protein, because that's going to be really hard to then keep it down. And that'd be a lot of fat, right? But an American diet, you can do that going to McDonald's and KFC and that sort of thing, if that's where you're getting it. But if you're getting it from whole foods, your carbs, it's going to be really hard then to beat that. That's pretty much like the secret recipe of the training road. That's the secret recipe for getting faster. And then some of these other things, I know I'm very much into I'm going to pay by Avenge to get the save that like 25 seconds on a 40K TT. But I can feel the want to buy these things and just hope that they work. But again, even the beetroot powder too, like the time when you take it and all this stuff,
I
bet if they didn't call it athletic greens, we wouldn't even be talking about it.
And good marketing.
I can understand the appeal of how convenient this sounds to just get all of so many nutritional needs from this like little powder, and you just have to, and I get it. Like, when will it relent? All we have to, like, all day, every day, all we think about is like what we're going to eat next and how to prepare it. Yeah, it's prison. I get it. But I just feel like this doesn't feel like even when, John, you're framing it as if you want to do something like this for overall health benefits, it's still, to me, from what these studies that you're showing and from our unknowns of how much of any of this is in one serving, it doesn't even feel in that regard like a guaranteed or sure bet way to make sure that you're getting these just general baseline health benefits versus just eating food.
Yeah, there's alkaline pea protein powder in this one, which, by the way, there was just a study published this week that looked at athletes and it dosed them. I'll link to this study too. It dosed them with the same diet, same everything, same exercise regimen. The only difference was one group got pea protein, one group got whey protein, and then they switched them. And so it was a double blinded study too. What they did is really good, solid study. And they found no difference in terms of like hypertrophy and everything else and different markers that they were testing with pea protein and whey protein. So that's pretty cool. I got my hopes up when I saw that it was in here. But the pea protein is part of their nutrient-dense extract, herbs, and antioxidant blend. And that's only 2.7 grams. And in order to take enough pea protein to get the sort of benefit that you would want, you want to be taking in like 2.2 grams per kilogram of body weight. So for me at 68 kilograms, that's only 1.8% of the protein that I would need in order to accomplish that sort of goal.
Oh my gosh.
So
that's total daily protein.
Total daily protein. Yeah. But if you're getting it from a recovery drink or anything else like that, you'd want a lot of more protein than, let's give them the benefit of the doubt and say 2.6 grams. So it leaves 0.1 gram, but 2.6 grams still isn't going to move the needle beneficially for what I need.
When you take in protein, it's for the, I'm going to mess this up. It's not the insulin response, or maybe it is, I forget. But in order to get the right response from your body, you want to have at least 20 grams in a bolus of protein. And that will work better than if you do like these like 2-3 grams throughout the day and meal. So if you can, if you're gonna have at least 20 grams per meal and the space it out during the day, you don't, doesn't have to be that way, but there's a better response. Total protein intake in the day trumps that than to space it out. But yeah, at least 20, let's say about 20, 25, I think, but I don't know, but around there.
Yeah.
It almost takes away the convenience factor for me to have to consider what you've just considered of how many grams are actually in and how many I would need, especially Nate, in one serving or at one time in order to get a benefit. Like, it almost takes away the convenience part of having something like this that's immediately available.
Yeah.
I'm such a killjoy today and about this, and I'm so sorry, but I just run from stuff like this. It feels like snake oil.
Yeah, for sure. 6.3, it's like a 6.3 times the cost of a Trainer Road subscription, an annual one.
And this one won't even make you science, get faster.
Yeah, science doesn't back up that it'll make you faster. I don't know. I wouldn't do it. This helped me. Thank you very much for asking this question, because this helped me satisfy that curiosity. I'm no longer going back to that cart and like sitting there and waiting and thinking to do it. So super helpful. Science wins again. McDonald's question says, good afternoon, guys. I'm a very happy Trainer Road user and a very average triathlete. We like you, McDonald. You're not average. You're great. I love the banter.
Average triathlete is like top 0.01% of the world for fitness. Sure. Yeah, yeah. You're amazing.
Good for you.
Totally. Probably even higher. Yeah.
Yeah. McDonald says, love the banter and working my way through the back catalog. Even though I have a coach, I hang on to my subscription because I have big cycling goals. I live and train in the Cayman Islands. Ooh, pretty cool. Which is Pancake Flat, obviously, and has 70 miles of beautiful but dangerous riding. I'm new to cycling and traveling to Jamaica for a 160-mile semi-competitive Grand Fondo in mid-October with 2,500 feet of climbing called Ride Your Bike Jamaica. The roads are reportedly awful, so I went out and bought 28-millimeter gator skins as a knee-jerk reaction. My aim is 1, to finish, 2, to enjoy, 3, be mid-pack for the final push to the end. So my question is, and I've Googled endlessly to find answers, but would love to hear your take. Am I going to be desperately unhappy on gator skins? I usually ride Pirelli Race or GP 5000s. Am I being too cautious with these gator skins? Thanks in advance. I have regret. Like, just for this person right here.
Do you remember the last time you tried to get a gator skin, like the bead over the rim on the gator skin?
I think I snapped 4 tire levers.
Gosh. I just...
It's rough.
If McDonald's goals are to finish and enjoy the ride and be mid-packish, I think that you should be focusing on things that you can control to try to prevent punctures and flats. And while the gator skins have this reputation for being impervious to punctures and bad road conditions and that you're less likely to flat, I feel like once you do flat, you're going to spend so much time trying to put another tube in and might just puncture or pinch again. And I know that these are not, like, Continental does not make tubeless gator skins. These are for sure just standard clinchers. Am I right about that?
Yeah, they're just clinchers. Yeah. They don't make them in, I don't know if they would sell very well. Sure. Yeah.
Continentals can come for us, man.
that's a good point though, Ivy, is that, look, if the roads have a ton of sharp things on them, gator skins are probably going to help a lot. If the roads have a lot of potholes where you're going to pinch flat, this is not going to help. Mm. Like, gator skins are not going to help against your pinch flats. The pinch flats that would happen, the way to go against that is a lot more expensive. That's going to a tubeless wheel set, running a tubeless tire, and then possibly even running inserts. That would be a really good combo if the roads are rough with potholes and the sort of thing that are going to give you pinch flats. But if it is just like sharp thorns all over the place, yes, gator skins will help with that. But I ran this course through Best Bike Split for me, and it said that I would do it in roughly around 7 hours. And then I looked up on bicycle rolling resistance, which I have my doubts about the accuracy of this in terms of real world conditions, but just the same. Bicycle rolling resistance says that compared, and this is in 25s, so your 28s are going to have a bit less drag than this, but just the same. For 25s, if you compare Gator Skins to GP5000s, there's an additional 20 watts of drag, 10 watts per tire that you're going to have to deal with. If you run that through Best Bike Split, that would mean that it would add on an additional roughly 30 minutes to that course. So out of 7 hours, just having those tires on would make me 30 minutes slower. That's a huge chunk of time. That's like a lot. So your goals, going back to them, my aim is number one, to finish. I'm not sure the Gator Skins will help you against pinch flats. And I would assume that's the problem if the roads are bad. So I don't know if they'll help with that. Number two, enjoy. It's going to make you be out there for 30 minutes extra, and that will make it less enjoyable, I would assume. And then three, be mid-pack for the final push to the end. If you're 30 minutes behind, I don't know, it might push you further away from that. But the only thing I'm thinking of is how scared I've been when I've ridden Gator Skins before. I've ridden them before, and they felt terrible. Like, I felt like they were slippery and like hard rubber, and I had no clue. And they, I don't, you used to ride them. I remember, didn't you?
Yeah. I would have been some of top 10 without
them. Some of my only, like, some of my only, what the heck just happened? How did I just crash randomly for no reason? Some of my only crashes like that have been on Gator Skins.
Yeah.
So I would do GP5000 TL, the tubeless, if you can do tubeless. Mm-hmm. If you haven't upgraded to tubeless, there's reasons not to do it.
Change your life.
Yeah.
Second, yeah. You live in the Cayman Islands, and what happens is in places that are don't have freezing, so the roads. So what happens when it freezes? You know, water gets into cracks, it freezes, expands, and you get these huge potholes. And Cayman Islands, I've been there. They don't have freezing, right? Like, it's just amazingly smooth and probably great roads. I just looked at some YouTube videos of Ride Your Bike Jamaica, and relative to the Caymans, it is still pretty good. But relative to Northern California, this would be a dream to ride on. It looks like I'm in South Africa, like those roads were amazing. Like Jamaica, it's not freezing either or snowing. It looks really nice. And you look at some of our race analysis in Northern California, like I'm thinking that one, what's the
Auburn?
One with the bridge? I forget, but there's a video where there's a bridge and just has 12 water bottles all around because people just get ejected. So I would look on here and look at more of the YouTube videos from people's races to see if there really are some potholes. And there's some like grates and not grates, but things they put in the road, the covers, and you got to watch out for mm-hmm. those, but like regular tires go over those just fine. I would totally do the GPL 5000 TLs. They have good flat protection. They have a good balance of rolling resistance. They corner pretty well. You're probably not going to be railing corners too much too on this. But they're great tires. Save 20 watts. That's insane. Yeah. So when somebody says it's bad roads, it might be relative to what you're used to, but I want to send it to you guys and just look at this thing. It looks like I would love it if Reno was like this.
Yeah. Our roads are not that great. So yeah, that's what I would say. Go back to your GP5000s. That's what you were using before. And if you can switch over to tubeless, boom, that's going to help a ton. If you're going to get inserts, Vittoria has some inserts that you can use in road tires that look fantastic. I haven't tried them, but they look great. And they wouldn't make it harder to change your tire necessarily either, which is really cool. So that's what I would recommend doing.
I just sent it to both of you guys. Can you just check for a second?
Yeah.
This looks.
For sure.
Maybe we can edit this part out or we can just talk. But I look at pictures too. I don't see a... What you got to do is you can't look at the race provider's pictures, right? You got to look at like camera footage from people's really? GoPros. Mm-hmm. Yeah, to see what it's really like. There are multi-hour YouTube videos of like roads around here, and you can see what it's going to look like. And they're pulling it up.
I'm just scanning through, and it looks really good. It's in an urban area, though, so maybe when you get into like rural areas, it's rougher, but
yeah.
I'm looking at this looks really good.
I'm looking at another video, and it still looks...
I want to go to this.
Yeah. Yeah, Ride Your Bike Jamaica organizers, we want to go. that looks amazing. Yeah. Wow. So that's what I would say. Just consider those GP5000s again.
I see another
like a
video with a couple like stuff, but it's still not to level of Northern California. In Northern California, I don't do the Vittorias that are like super fast. I would do GPL 5000 TLs and two, you can be able to change them later if you get a flat and put a tube in. That's the way to go.
Yeah. Yep. And with that too, if it's thorns and you're worried about that, then going to tubeless is going to help you it's so much more than going to a gator skin. Tubeless is amazing with thorns. All right, last question from James. This one's going to be pretty quick. It says, I have a question about how to handle pre-race nerves the night before a race. I recently did my first Olympic distance triathlon. The night before the race, I barely slept. My mind was just going and I couldn't turn it off. Given what we all know about sleep and how it's beneficial, I can't help but think this inhibited my performance. I definitely felt it during the race, and I definitely feel I could have gone faster. What are your recommendations for reducing these pre-race nerves to help get a good night's sleep the night before a big race? Thanks for your help, from James. I threw this one in. Ivy, you just had your first UCI races. Mm-hmm. You had your first one, then this weekend another one. Do you struggle with this?
Not anymore, because I don't lay awake thinking of every mistake I've ever made anymore. So that's cool.
Good for you, Ivy.
Yeah. Yeah, this is tricky. I feel like folks that, and I used to be this person too, that would just lie awake and stress out about all of these possible outcomes and probable expectations I should have, and if it's realistic, and what if this happens, and did I do enough? What were my competitors doing to prepare? Did I do enough to prepare? And I feel like I stopped doing this and really like found a lot of peace and ease in believing that I did everything I could. Whether it was enough or not to be competitive or not, like I did what I could with what I had, and now I'm here and there's nothing more I can control or change right now other than going to sleep and getting rest and making sure I'm squared away in the morning. So I think letting go of a lot of those unknowns about how it can turn out and did I do enough and all that stuff, just like understanding and reconciling with I can't change any of it now, has really helped me. Plus CBD.
Yeah. Nate, you're like you've been a big sleep optimizer in the past.
And a big nervous person too. Mm-hmm. James, first, anything, this is going to happen. It happens with not most people. Ivy's obviously experienced. So when she does those I-class race, how many I-class races have you done, Ivy?
Oh my gosh.
Don't even.
No, I don't know, a lot.
Yeah. Over 12? Yeah.
More than 12. Yeah. 10. Yeah.
So lots of races, but
more.
I used to worry about this too. And I actually alluded to it earlier on in the podcast about sleep the night before versus how many days, does that really impact that next day or does it days past that? And I remember watching an interview with Chrissy Wellington, and it was after she had won Ironman World Championships. And she's probably one of the most dominant in the history of the world. And she told the interviewer by Bob Abbott or something, she says, I didn't sleep at all before this race. I was so nervous. She goes, every time at World Champions, I try to sleep. Like I don't sleep a single bit. I am so nervous and so scared. But as soon as the gun goes off, then I feel good. And I was like, oh, if she can do it, I can do it. And I'm sure she rests later. But considering the length of that race, so hard compared to most races we do, that I don't, and two, you have a taper coming in. You're not doing a hard workout the day before. The idea is you can get past that one. I'm sure if you did this 3 or 4 days in a row, it'd be hard. But I wouldn't sweat it, James, and just be like, if the world champ does this, and a lot of people do it, I've heard it too with Olympians and stuff, because they only get a shot every 4 years. How nervous can you be doing those things? Even if it's your sport that you do all the time, the Olympics are a different level. I would just, you're with good company. They're all doing it. Just get as much as you can and visualize success. So inside of these things, instead of visualizing the worst that could happen, think about going through your transitions. What am I going to do in what order? What kind of thing? You can do meditation during the day. That'll help too. Deep breathing. We just did one at Trina Road. It was pretty cool. Some breathing exercises. You don't want to meditate right before bed because that can do some stuff that will make it actually stay up later. And I wouldn't do any like Benadryl or therapy. Yeah. I wouldn't do any Benadryl or stuff like that too the night before because the hangover of doing that can be, I'd be worried about performance hitting the other side. But yeah.
There's studies about that, specifically about Benadryl being like a performance inhibitor, like directly.
Yeah. Correct. Yeah, histamines do that. For me to feel what Ivy feels, that I've done all that I can and I'm set there, it's more about just being prepared. So I have to know when I'm going to wake up already, know when I'm going to eat my breakfast, know when I'm going to get to the race. And I write all that down. I write my schedule down beforehand. And then I make sure that I have everything packed beforehand. It's all those little things that might cause me to feel rushed or nervous or scared or something or frustrated in the morning. I take care of those beforehand. And just taking care of those little details really helps me personally sleep better. The other thing is I try to anticipate my sleep schedule coming in to the race. If I'm going to have to go to bed earlier than normal, then I start doing that a week before, getting as close as I can to it. because then it makes it a lot easier to not and suddenly just, oh, race night, I have to completely change up my routine and go to bed way earlier. That makes it really tough. Then you find yourself sitting there, and if you're by your phone, you end up scrolling on your phone and staying up extra late or something. Modify your routine beforehand, and that can really help with it. There's a ton of different sleep hacks. Like we were just talking about Athletic Greens. There's a lot of different things that you can do to spend a lot of money on sleep stuff that will promise to improve your sleep. But honestly, if you're just trying to get close to 8 hours, and then if you're making sure that you have a consistent routine beforehand, it's going to help a ton. And if that doesn't have to change for race day, boom, that's great. Then you're like really in a good spot, because then it's just your normal routine. If you can go into your race feeling like it's a normal day, that just puts you way, way far ahead on things. So
yeah, James, trust in the work that you've done, control what you can control that's within your means to control, and chill out. It's fine.
Agreed.
It's the being anxious or anxiety is worrying about the unknown, what's going to happen. And what John just said is like laying things out. So there's like a system to walk through. It removes variables of unknown. And these two people, like I would always, triathlon people get scared about the swim. Am I going to finish? Am I going to make this mistake or something like that? Am I not going to eat or drink?
I'm going to drown.
Yeah. Yeah. That's so
for some of us.
Yeah. And
yeah.
So the more you can
prepare,
like you can identify what these are and prepare yourself that these aren't going to be an issue. It really helped. I've had some recurring nightmare for me is I get to T1 and my tire's not pumped up, or there's like my bike is not put together for some reason, and I have to do it
weird.
As everyone else goes. Like that, I probably had the dream 10 times. This is crazy. Yeah.
So was that before the torquing your bolts scenario?
Yeah. My body was trying to tell me like my subconscious was saying, pay attention, but I didn't listen. My tires were pumped though.
Crazy.
Is that tire thing even a thing that happened, or just like a hypothetical that you're afraid of?
Hypothetical. Yeah. No, not hypothetical. Yeah. It was just, I'm not afraid of it like with my conscious mind, but my subconscious was like the idea of there and something not be ready.
Mm-hmm. I think that when you race more and more, you become more aware of those subconscious fears that exist, and you find ways to be able to engineer against them. So then you can put that at ease better and better. Cool. Thanks a bunch for submitting your questions. You can do that at trainerroad.com/podcast. And if you're listening to this podcast and you want to get faster, we've covered a bunch of different ways to do it. Best way is to go sign up for Trainer Road. Go use Plan Builder, build out your whole season of training for whatever goals you have. And that's the way to do it. If you like this podcast, the best way to do it is to share, or best way to share appreciation is to share it with your friends. Review it on any podcast app that you're using. And on YouTube, you should go there, subscribe to our YouTube channel, give us a thumbs up, go on Instagram, find us, go on TikTok. You'll see fantastic content from Sarah, Ivy, and myself. We're always trying to find different ways to help you get faster. You can get all that stuff there. But we appreciate you all. Talk to you next time. Thanks.
Bye-bye.